You're listening to a Times Higher Education podcast.
Hello and welcome to this Times Higher Education issue review podcast for the edition covering the 16th to the 22nd of January 2014. My name is Chris Barr. We're celebrating a bit. This is the 100th THE podcast since we started recording in November 2012, but no time to dwell on past glories, packed issue that we need to get through. I'm joined by reporters David Matthews and Holly Else, writer Matthew Rice and editor John Gill. Misleading university prospectuses are the topic of this week's lead news story. David will have some news on universities that have been a bit economical with the truth, let's say, in their prospectuses. As researchers work with bigger and bigger data sets, how can we stop it from causing them bigger and bigger headaches? Holly has some more on that. Poker, you've got to know when to hold them, when to fold them. Matthew writes this week on poker playing academics. And our cover feature we'll cover finally features subjects that won and those that lost following the boom in HE enrolment that's been seen since 1997. But first up, David, the lead news story this week, prospectuses.
Yes, this story is based on a paper which is both quite eye-popping and quite amusing in places. It's basically been done by a guy who's gone through 8 randomly selected undergraduate university prospectuses and taken out all of the data-based claims in them and then gone through with a sort of fine-tooth comb to see whether they are accurate or misleading. And he's found quite a few dodgy claims, basically. I mean, in one case, a prospectus said its department rating, its teaching was rated as excellent, but it failed to mention this had actually been based on something done in 1994, so almost 20 years out of date.
So its teaching was excellent, very much the past tense.
But probably further ago than the students might have imagined from reading it.
Before you were born, we were excellent.
Yeah, exactly. In another case, it said, we are in the top 10, nationally for this area on the 2008 research assessment exercise. However, they also didn't mention that there were only 14 departments, so they're below average, but they were in the top 10.
So they're making the top 80% roughly thereabouts.
Exactly. And so there were 22 examples of misleading claims ranging from outside, total falsehoods to kind of dodgy cause and effect implications. Now, it doesn't name them, but we've managed to kind of Google various phrases in the paper and identified 3 of the universities involved, which is Hull, Cardiff University, and the University of Glasgow. I mean, Hull had an interesting one. So it claims that they are one of the top 5 northern universities for student satisfaction. The paper FOIs the basis for this claim, and it turns out their definition of northern doesn't exclude universities in Greater Manchester, Liverpool, Cumbria, or Lancashire.
Doesn't include those areas.
Most of the north, basically. And it's a serious point here because it goes on to say, well, even for a commercial company to do this would be slightly suspect, but shouldn't universities have even higher standards? I mean, they are appealing to 17-year-olds, some with no family or wider experience of university, and also they're trusted in society because they don't sort of sex up all their statistics. Mm. That's the kind of root of universities or authority. Other people have claimed that the author's being slightly pedantic in some of his criticisms. But it's
issue. Chris described it as economical with the truth. Some of them are outright lies, aren't they, really?
Yeah.
I mean, if you cut to the chase on it. And I noticed, actually, that we have an advertisement in the magazine this week, which is not from any of the universities involved here, but for a public relations officer. And it explicitly says that in the new marketised higher education sector, PR is going to become ever more important. So universities are really, getting to grips with that now and taking that on. And really, this doesn't paint a pretty picture of what PR departments are perhaps doing in some instances. So I think it is a matter of concern. The other thing I'd say, David, at the start of when you first described this story, you said this paper was eye-popping and entertaining. That is an excellent marketing line. I think we should say that THE as a paper is eye-popping and entertaining. That will be my marketing line coming up for 2014.
Well, look out on the front cover of the next issue for that. Holly, let's hear a bit more from your story this week. Big data. obviously researchers are generating larger and larger and larger databases of information that they need to assess. You've been writing about something called the CRISP project. What's it all about?
Yeah, so the CRISP project basically looks is a way of researchers can deal with the increasing amount of data they get when they use the big science infrastructure projects such as CERN or the European Synchrotron Radiation Facility. These massive big science projects perhaps see hundreds of researchers through their doors in a year. They come for a few days to do specific research, and then they go back to their home institution to analyse the data. Now, the issue is that as these machines become more and more complicated, much more data is collected during the experiments. Mm. The scientists now have a bit of a challenge on their hands to sort of store and manage and process those huge data amounts. So the CRISP project is a collaboration of about 11 of these big research infrastructures in Europe, and it's basically sort of an e-infrastructure, so online and via the computer, which basically is a way of storing, handling the data for the researchers. So one of the outcomes will be that researchers will be able to search the experiments they've done in these big facilities in the same way that they can search their email inbox, which is not sort of currently done at the moment. At the moment, these researchers often store the results on spreadsheets or in notebooks, which perhaps aren't easy to search.
That's the problem. I mean, there's probably some astounding findings out there that have already been made, but which nobody's noticed. I mean, the amount of data that these things. I mean, you mentioned CERN there. The amount of data it can collect and publish at once means it's probably finding out all sorts of things.
Yeah, we spoke to a professor of chemistry, Julian Eastow, at the University of Bristol, and he actually admitted, although he said it rather coyly, that he's had to redo experiments before because he couldn't find the data. He'd done. It might be an experiment he did 8 years ago or something, but essentially it's a bit of a waste of his time if he can't just go and find this data to use it. One of the guys at the European Synchrotron Radiation Facilities, Rudolf Dimper, he's the head of technical infrastructure, and he said that actually when these guys come to visit the facility, they spend more time now putting the data onto discs to take home with them than they do actually doing the experiments. So being able to access it remotely will make a massive difference for them.
Yeah, it reminds me of last month I wrote about the new UK infrastructure for online communication, JISC, Janet 6 is called, and one of the main reasons that's been so important is precisely what you said there. As more data is produced, let's face it, most university projects are done in collaboration. It needs to be sent between institutions, and doing that is a real nightmare if you've not got the technology to do it. So it sounds like this is another approach to maybe solving that problem. But moving on, maybe I should I'll grab a pack of cards for this next item on the agenda, give them a shuffle, deal them out to each of you there we go. Poker.
Bad hands.
That's no, this, well, don't need,
you're not,
you
haven't shuffled these properly.
You're not a good bluffer, David. Matthew, you're a keen poker player. This week you're writing about academics who play the game. Was this just indulging your hobby? What was the reason for this piece?
Well, I mean, I guess I play poker made me interested, but I then started talking to some academics and what they got out of poker beyond just a pleasant evening, and it was quite interesting. There's sort of, because I think they're two rather different, almost opposite views. One is that poker is a great training for life, and indeed academic life as well. It helps you manipulate and outwit other people. It makes you take calculated risk. It may even prepare you for the inevitable frustrations of life and so on. So it's kind of training for life. The other view is that it's a sort of antidote to the sort of dullness of the rest of one's life. And so gamblers talk about something called action, which tends to mean either risking a lot of money, dangerous sports, seduction, things like this, where you're kind of putting yourself on the line, and this sort of cuts through the sort of dullness of most of your life. And of course, the thing about academic life is there is a lot of delayed gratification. You do some research now, and it's not actually going to be out saving lives for 10, 15 years. Mm. And do people need a kind of adrenaline rush of sort of instant excitement? And so people were talking about these things. And of course, the other thing about poker is it's sort of ultimate boys' game, and how it has adapted, whether people want to play with women, who what is it different if there are men and women involved, and so on. So there are some quite entertaining and interesting things to be said about this.
Mm-hmm. I just wonder whether you interviewed some economists who were involved in it, and you know, did it help them in their understanding of game theory and those kind of economic riddles at all? Can they use their economics training to beat, you know, humanities?
Well, I think
the table.
The economist I quote, he said that he thought economics was very good because he's pretty quick with numbers, so he understands the odds. But he's also, the social science aspect means that he's quite good at reading people. And I know a group of people academics who play, they're all in there in English department, English and soil sciences, but they seem to not reach agreement about which is better training for the poker table.
Both are pretty bad.
Sounds to me like David maybe lost a lot of money to an economist one day. Very good. Anyway, let's just settle that hand up and see. Yes, Matthew, indeed, it seems your practice has paid off. That's it's a comfortable win for you. Here you go. Here are your chips.
Thank you.
Very good. Finally, the cover feature this week. It's back to you, David. A huge piece of work, spread over about 8 pages, I think, in this week's edition, about enrolment numbers for different subjects since 1997. Why is this piece coming out now, and what's it all about?
Well, yes, I don't want to see another Excel sheet for about another 2 months after this.
It's a bit of a monster.
Just at the end of last year, we had the kind of surprise announcement by George Osborne that student undergraduate numbers are going to be uncapped after the next election, and that'll mean about 60,000 new students should enter the system. So what we've done, we've kind of looked back over the past 16 years, I mean the majority of it the new Labour years, when there was this huge boom in student numbers. There's about 42% increase overall, basically. I mean, that's kind of well known, but what we wanted to dig down into is actually which subjects have increased, which have flatlined, which have decreased, because it has enormous implications for, you know, which departments do well, which areas of the economy are successful in the long run. And there's some really surprising and interesting results. I mean, the first part of the piece is about the kind of new subjects, often that are kind of pilloried in the sort of more right-wing elements of the press. I mean, media studies has gone from just about 7,000 students when New Labour came to power to almost 32,000 students by 2011-12. That's huge. I mean, that's eclipsed, you know, all of these kind of really long-standing subjects like philosophy and so on, and classics and what have you. There's other things like sports science, which isn't even recorded in the data as a separate subject until about 2002. And by the end of the period, it's got about 40,000 students. And these are huge growth, and you know, it basically fundamentally changes the shape of what people do and what universities are. But this writing that part of the feature, it felt like, well, this is sort of grist the mill of the Daily Mail. It's all of these kind of new subjects which account for the increase. But that's not totally true. Some humanities have done pretty well. Politics, economics, psychology.
Yeah, politics wasn't present, was it, in 97 at all in the top 10, I think, you published, and it made the list for last year's figures?
So it goes up to 2011-12, yes. And yes, it's now sort of entered the charts, as it were, along with actually maths has done very well.
Mm-hmm. And the other thing I'd say, as far as the sort of, you know, to these figures back, the sort of Daily Mail line about new soft subjects taking over and so on, one of the things that's striking in these figures is just how dominant business and management is as an area of study. I mean, it's just got far, far more students than any other in the land, and I think that probably includes a lot of international students too. But I think there's a very interesting line in the feature from Sir Peter Scott, who says, well, politicians might like to come out and grandstand and slag off disciplines like business and management and say that they're perhaps not as tough as physics or whatever it might be, but actually, he says students and universities have a much better idea than politicians do about the subjects that they're going to go on and get them jobs and where the economy is in terms of, you know, employability and the things that they want to study. So why shouldn't these subjects that are, you know, equipping people perhaps for the economy that we have in 2014 flourish? I mean, that's kind of the way it should be.
We've heard a lot under the coalition about kind of creating a market and getting competition for students. But what this also kind of shows more broadly is that well, actually, there has been a sort of market for students. Mm. I mean, it's kind of, you know, where they've been interested in new subjects, they've grown massively, and where universities have wanted to put them on. It's a sort of supply and demand that's been working, even in theory, a system that is pretty state-controlled.
Well, within the cap system, the supply and demand has driven which subjects have grown and which haven't. I mean, there are some weird anomalies in there, aren't there? The figures that David quotes about complementary medicine being three, four times larger as a subject than Chinese studies, when we're in the Asian century and we should really be looking east and equipping ourselves to deal with, you know, a century where China is preeminent, and instead we're all studying Chinese medicine.
Yeah, if you were a sort of economic planner, you know, planning the future of the UK economy, there would be some figures in here that would make you sort of recoil in horror a little bit, but others that might give you cause for comfort.
Well, it's an interesting analysis. You can go through all those figures in this week's cover story. And that's all for this week's issue review. We're all off to the pub where Matthew can buy us a round with his newfound fortune. There's another podcast out tomorrow. That's Friday, if you're listening to this on the day the magazine came out. It's another books podcast with Karen Shook, our books editor. She's speaking to Trevor Cox, who is Professor of Acoustic Engineering at the University of Salford and author of this week's Book of the Week, Sonic Wonderland, A Scientific Odyssey of Sound. So do look out for that. Until then, you can get us on the website, timeshighereducation.co.uk. Find us on Twitter at Times Higher Ed. We're also on LinkedIn, Facebook and Google+. Do get in touch, but that's all for this week's Times Higher Education Issue Review podcast.
You're listening to a Times Higher Education podcast.